Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We are teaching America the power of ethical-only persuasion. Complicated times out there require some sophisticated techniques, so let's learn some of those. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late-night comedy writer, stand-up comic, and mixed rhetoric and comedy. That's what I do. Founder of Rhetoric Warriors. The podcast here, I have three purposes. I talk to comedians about their politics and their careers because you never know what's going to come out of those heads. So that's fun. I convert conservatives. So send me a conservative. We'll talk. I always tell people, if you don't want to change your mind, don't get into a conversation with me. That's kind of what I do. And I talk to persuasion pros, and people have social issues that they're pushing into the world, and straight up academic rhetoricians. More rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you're going to hear today. That's my promise. My guest today is the host of a podcast himself, The Locker Room, former publicist at As the World Turns and Guiding Light, which I actually have a connection to. We'll talk about today. Extensive experience, all areas of promotion and publicity, including red carpet events, the Academy Awards, the Emmys, the Webbies, the People's Choice Awards. Those are ranked somehow, right? The Academy has to be first, I guess. Everybody, welcome Alan Locker.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. I'm glad you didn't introduce me as comedian, because I'm not going to make people laugh like you do.
Oh, you never know. Maybe you just haven't hit your stride yet.
Okay. I'll take your word for that. There you go. Persuasion.
Yeah. See, right off the bat, you're now a whole new character, have a whole new career. Took us 30 seconds. So, Locker, like, is that, how do people pronounce that usually?
It is pronounced Locker. It's a French descent. My parents were Dutch, but my dad's side is, so it's actually Locher, but I get a lot of Locher along the way. And when I'm on the telephone, it's funny, for some reason, people think I say Walker.
Really?
Yeah. Walker, Alan Walker. And it's funny, I've got a friend, Alan Walker, but no, it's Locker.
I was just talking to my daughter on FaceTime before we jumped on this call, and she's in Amsterdam today.
Oh, wow. That's where my parents were born.
Yeah. And it's freaking her out. She's never heard Dutch, and she's never tried to read Dutch. And most people there speak English as well. So she's fine, but she's just walking around. She's like, there's a whole, set of sounds that I've never had in my ears before.
What's she doing there?
She's in France finishing her final year of college. She did as a transfer student from Texas over to France for a year. So she's traveling, checking
lucky,
it out.
Lucky gal. That's one of my biggest regrets, is not studying abroad. It really
is. Certainly seems like something. Yeah, I was in Ohio. I could have used some abroad.
It's funny. I was at the physical therapist, and I heard the physical therapist and another woman talking about her child who was studying abroad, I think in the UK. And I was just so envious.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like, so I grew up in Kentucky, right? And I was the first person in my family to go to college. So none of these ideas ever entered my sphere. I tell my kids all the time, like, if the starting line is here, I started back here. You guys have started here, which means you need to go a lot farther than I did, because they were raised in LA and Australia and Austin. So she's got an idea of living a big life.
That's awesome. But studying abroad, I just think the amount of education, you may not be even going for that. You're going to take, whatever class or curriculum that you're there for, but the experience of having to live in another country to their, to their customs and their way of life just teaches you things you would never expect.
Yeah, it's just the crazy minutia of any culture that you're in that you absorb takes you in such different directions, which is kind of the reasons, one of the reasons why I was interested, so interested in talking to you today. Like, you've been in some really kind of unique situations, right? Like, even your jobs, we'll get to it here in a second, but take us through your background a little bit. Orient everybody to the Locher experience here?
Starting where? As far back as I... Well,
where are you from?
I grew up in New Jersey, and back here living in New Jersey, which I never thought I would do. I grew up in North Jersey in a town called Richfield. And as a sophomore in college, I sort of the power of persuasion. Here we go. You know, I was working. I was going to Fairleigh Dickinson University, which was local. I, you know, didn't live away. And I was studying what I thought was sort of the appropriate thing to make me some money, which was going to be an accountant. I mean, that was my idea. And I was working at a health club and talking to one of the customers. And I think she just probably asked me, you know, what did I really want to do? And I said, I really wanted to work in the entertainment industry. And somebody nicely overheard that conversation. She worked in human resources at ABC Television. And she said, we have a page program and you should apply. And that basically changed the course of my life. It opened every door. So I was a sophomore in college, literally like going to school from 8 to 2 in the afternoon. I'd get on a bus to New York City and work at ABC Television from like 4 to midnight or vice versa. Like I would get up for, you know, 4:35 a.m. to work at Good Morning America and then get on a bus to go to school from like 2 to 8 p.m. or something like that. But literally somebody just...
Yeah, that's fascinating, right? Like
overheard. Yeah. I mean, it really did. It changed everything for me.
Yeah. It's really interesting too. Like I tell people all the time, you know, I have people's kids and stuff who talk to me about getting into Hollywood or getting, you know, into the entertainment industry. And I'm like always the same thing, kind of like what you did, just get in any way, become a page, you know, PA, anything like that, where you can get around and you can start to absorb this and see if it's really what you want to do. And
all internship that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Internship. Yeah. Internship is such an integral, especially in the entertainment business. I mean, some of them can be, you know, I think a little abusive, but
a little, yeah. Yeah, it would be a lot. That's
probably,
that's kind of the nature of the industry. Although, you know, like when I was at Dennis Miller, we had an intern from somewhere in New York, Columbia, maybe. And we're all sitting there while I'm watching the taping, all the comedy writers who had written the show. And she's like going, she's just so sour. She's like, all these jokes are terrible. I'm like, you know, you're sitting around all the people right now who wrote who these jokes, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I don't care.
So funny, but it is true. I mean, you know, it really opens doors. And you actually said it in the sense of just being in the space. You know, absorbing that environment. Not everybody, like being a page, we had the opportunity to be on different sets and different things. And it always amazed me, people weren't really taking advantage, but I guess they were not probably like I was looking to get into that business. But it's such, you know, open your eyes when you're in that environment. You know, even on the locker room, talking to some actors or something, like, just being on set for them can be a learning experience.
Right. Yeah. And I'm like you, like I've always absorbed, I love being in new environments and absorbing all the things that people already know. Cause especially in entertainment, almost everybody in those environments is going to be a super pro. Like they've been doing it for a long time. They're fast. They don't make a lot of mistakes. You can just learn so much so fast by just being around them and watching what they do.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's like absorption. Really, you know, it, especially if it's the industry you want to be in. I mean, if you're working at a magazine, an internship, you know, watching somebody write or do an interview or whatever it is, accountant, if that's what I had, you know, done.
Yeah. The exciting world of backstage accounting. Here we go.
Watching somebody crunch numbers.
Yeah. So tell me, so you were a page, take us.
I was a page. One of the jobs that I worked on, or one of the shows I worked on, was The Morning Show, which The Morning Show became Live with Regis and Kathy Lee. And at that time it was called The Morning Show because it was a local show just seen in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And Again, I just used that opportunity and, you know, I sort of was well liked. And before I even graduated college, I had a job working on the morning show and then launched the show into syndication, which basically led to my job working for 8 years in the movie division at the Walt Disney Company, which for a kid out of college, it was like a candy store. You know, I worked on over like 200 movies, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Sister Act, Dead Poets Society, Lion King, Aladdin. Really,
so
some
take
of
us. So I'm like I said, I'll get really fascinated by the inner culture of places. So take us, first of all, to the morning show. So take us through that experience as a job. Like, what were you doing? And like you said, it transitioned into a national syndicated show.
So as a page, you know, as a page, you had the opportunity. I mean, I interacted with, you know, presidents, celebrities. Part of that was escorting them into the building, escorting them from the green room to the set, getting them to sign paperwork that was neat, you know, legal things. If somebody's performing, they get paid, certain things like that. So you really had interaction with high level individuals, whether I was, directly speaking to Halle Berry or whoever it was their people, but it was them. And then when they needed to get on set to be introduced to be the guest, that was our job as a page. Here we are in our polyester uniforms and polyester tie and walking them to the set. So it was really, you know, quite a introduction for somebody who wanted to be in the entertainment business, a pretty great introduction. And when I was near graduation, there was a opening for a production coordinator. And production coordinator, again, does a lot of different things. One of them was I basically would write out cue cards. It wasn't scripted, but it was basically like, today is Thursday, August 26th. And, you know, you would, you know, have that. And coming up next is President Jimmy Carter or whoever. And so that production coordinator position I went for, but they, at the time, diversity wasn't as big, I think, as it is today, but they were looking for someone, I think, a little more diverse than myself. I think Jewish and gay is pretty diverse.
You know, I make this argument all the time. Like, people, like, if you look at my guest list for my podcast, it's predominantly, it's like 95% middle-aged white guys. And I'm like, well, that's not by choice. I talk to everybody. Like, I invite a lot of people. Those are the guys that say yes to me because I've known them forever. And yeah, demographically, you can look at it and go, hey, not much diversity. But if you actually talk to those people from like class and personality and jobs and all that stuff, it's a major diversity. So I'm always like, come on, let's expand this diversity, you know, criteria a little bit. I totally am down with the idea of, yes, we need to, you know, make sure the populations that haven't had advantages in the hiring process now can at least be equal. But yeah, it's like, come on, white guys are diverse too.
That's what I thought. I wanted that job and I got it. I mean, they needed to hire someone. So I had it for a few months. And then when the show was going into syndication, because I had made an impression, I guess, with both Regis and Kathy Lee, they went to bat with the Walt Disney Company, who was syndicating them. And I got a job working sort of in the syndication arm for the show for a little while. And the movie office and the syndication office were in the same building on the same floor. And sadly, somebody got sick on the movie side and didn't return to their job. And a job opened up and I took it immediately and stayed for almost 8 years and 200 movies. But after 200 movies and basically spending 5 days a week at the movies, it was time for something else.
Yeah. You know, the glamour of the movies loses its glamour at a certain point, right?
Well, you're seeing a lot of times you're seeing the same one, sometimes like two or three times during the week. And again, I mean, out of college, there was not a better job for somebody who was single and not tied down. Incredible. And the amount of learning that I basically, because I didn't go to school for public relations, I basically learned a lot about marketing and PR there. And I mean, what's a better marketer than Disney?
Yeah, that has never existed on the planet. There are no better marketers. I tell people all the time, like I've done a lot of work for people in the alternative health space. You know, they're always trying to sell a new approach to health, new approach to eating, working out, whatever. And I'm like, you know, just use the, like American capitalism has figured out how to promote things. Like if you walk into Hooters, it's sex, sports, and, you know, alcohol.
Chicken wings.
Right? I mean, come on. Yeah. Cheap food, sports, sex, and alcohol. Just use that. You know, quit trying to sell, oh, we're so healthy and moral. You know, throw some actual marketing at it, but they never listen to me.
That's funny. Yeah. And, you know, I left Disney and went to a PR firm for about a year, worked on about 5 different accounts.
So let me drag you back again into
Disney. Yeah, sure.
A little bit. So talk about that job. Like what was your, give some of the texture of your job there.
I mean, I basically started as someone's assistant in the promotions division, which was basically, we were, so it was.
Hey, a little note. I think your hands are hitting the table or something. So we're getting some audio.
Oh, sure, sure. Tell me if that's better. So the marketing department was PR and promotion. And so the promotion side was really setting up, you know, like for Sister Act, we would do a movie screening for 500 nuns, you know. So, but I was the assistant working for the head of promotions, and we basically managed 28 advertising agencies around the country that basically helped us do PR and promotions in each city.
Right.
So like Cincinnati, Philadelphia, you know, the major markets we had an agency in. And I worked, I don't remember how long I was in the promotions area. And then a job opened up in the public relations. And I started as someone's assistant, I believe, and then moved into doing, Disney had broken down some of the PR areas. So like I think I handled like teen and sci-fi. So I would be pitching anything sci-fi teen related. So if we had a sci-fi movie or, you know, teen actors in a movie, I would be pitching publications to get exposure to promote the movies. And then I basically worked my way up to a senior publicist handling print and broadcast, which was all national newspapers and all broadcast outlets, like basically coming full circle and pitching Regis and Kathy Lee to have Whoopi Goldberg on there to promote Sister Act.
Do you have any pitching tips that you developed over the years? Like, you know, I tell people, like, again, nobody outside of professional communication people understands what professional communication people really do. Right.
Correct.
Like in the same way with rhetoric, like you come into this, you're like, oh, academic area I've never even heard of, what goes on over there? And then you start to see when you get into something like publicity or promotions, just the sort of inner skills, the small skills, like being able to call somebody and pitch quickly and keep it friendly and all that kind of stuff that you develop, and you see people who are super talented at it. And everybody's like, oh, okay, I guess, you know, there is an infrastructure.
It's a lot of people skills and a lot of creativity sometimes. I mean, at a place like Disney, I mean, you know, they have executives who really lay down the plan for the most part. But I mean, they let you be creative. I mean, one of the highlights of you know, working there was working on the world's largest movie premiere at the time, which was the premiere of Pocahontas in Central Park for 100,000 people, where we literally, you know, took over the Great Lawn, built 3 movie screens and did like this incredible production. And I pitched to one of the local stations in New York, WWOR, to do a behind the scenes, which turned out to be a 3-hour live show from Central Park while we were doing the premiere. So basically, like, as the, you know, people were entering the park and, you know, some of the live performances before the movie played, they were doing a lot of live segments from the park. And then during the movie, they played a lot of taped pieces that we did on the making of the movie. So it was an incredible.
That's a lot of moving parts.
A lot of moving parts. And it was, you know, an incredible experience. I mean, like, you know, Disney has had a, you know, put on a show basically, and they did.
You know, when you can sell a mouse to the whole world for 75 years, you're a good marketer.
That's a great way of putting it. But yeah. Talk about the power of persuasion.
Yeah. And we mentioned this, like when we were talking on Lunch Club, I think that, you know, rhetoric is, it's got a bunch of theory that people don't really access that much anymore, but it really came back up in advertising and publicity and marketing. Like, it uses a lot of the same stuff. It just doesn't call it rhetoric. It just doesn't know that history is there, you know, behind it. So you see a lot of people who get really good at, especially public influence like that. And Disney clearly, you know, 100 years of experience selling things like this and this massive infrastructure behind it. Like, how are you going to beat that? I mean, that's really one of the strongest persuasion machines ever made.
Seriously. I mean, every movie, it is a, you know, once the gate is lifted to start promoting it, it's hard for anybody to miss something that they're, you know, saying about, you know, Pocahontas, Woody, you know, Buzz Lightyear, Mickey Mouse, you know, it really is. It's,
well, and it's fascinating too, again, going across my worlds from something like politics, where I'm doing a lot of work right now. So you have the vaccines right now, and everybody's still, there's these, you know, warring tribes over the vaccines. Mm-hmm. Like, well, I'll tell you what, if Disney had decided to spend $100 million on a vaccine promotion or whatever it would be, this would not be an argument. They would have gotten this done.
I've never heard it put that way, but you are 100% correct.
The government doesn't have that. They don't have those creative resources. They don't have people like you that have worked in the infrastructure and the guts of all this stuff, who know what it takes to get that in there and to make it work. It's just a massive machine, and it doesn't really get used for good.
And we really need it. I mean, it's crazy, the divide on vaccines, not even on vaccines, it's on fact.
Yeah, it goes in science. Across, yeah, it's propaganda. You know, it's not, like,
right.
Well, it's people don't really understand that the Republicans have an infrastructure, a Disney-like infrastructure to their messaging. It starts with, like, the Koch brothers, and they, you know, they fund everything, and it goes to think tanks, which come up with the messaging and the scripting. And then it's handed down all the way to the right wing media. And it's just like a Disney infrastructure, and it's just as funded and talent driven and everything else. The left doesn't have that. They scramble, and each little camp tries to make a message, trying to fight this huge monolith infrastructure that is the Disney of the right, which is a great way of thinking about it. So, thanks. I'm going to use that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a powerful machine they have, definitely, to realize that we're in this position, you know, it's just, you know.
Well, think about that you just said, like, getting 100,000 people to go to Central Park to watch essentially a movie about colonialism gone good. Yeah. The happy natives, you know, who help us out. And that's amazing.
It's true. I mean, that's why, you know, for somebody coming out of college, like that, my first job, I mean, you know, we had a premiere for Aladdin at Walt Disney World, you know, elephants and, you know, all these things marching down the street. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the machine is incredible with companies like that.
Cool. All right. So thanks for describing that for people. Now you understand why Disney gets, you know, gets your kids, like, mesmerized.
It gets really the adults too.
Yeah.
It really does.
They're amazing. Okay. So you left Disney and you spent PR for a little while. And
it was a PR company that basically, like, it's considered what's called the account side. So you, when you're out on the account side, you get more than one client. So I had Jackie Mason. I had a magic show on Broadway. I had the Teletubbies. I had the partnership for the homeless. It was a great year. But I basically grew up watching As the World Turns and Guiding Light because my parents.
All right. I'm going to drag you back again. Teletubbies.
The Teletubbies.
You were a publicist for the Teletubbies.
Well, it was a company in New York City called the Itsy Bitsy Entertainment Company that brought the Teletubbies to America.
Like on a boat, yeah. Like King Kong, like they had.
No. Just the brought boat. The show, brought the show and the brand to America.
If there's ever, you know, any question about the power of what media can do, we're going to sell this LSD vision of four little creatures, and your Tinky babies Winky. Are going to love it.
Was that it? Tinky Winky? I can't. Yeah
I think that's probably one of them, surely.
The purple one, Tinky Winky or something like that. God, it was pretty great, though. I did go to, got a business trip to London. And sadly, just before I decided to leave, so the Itsy Bitsy Entertainment Company wasn't too happy. But so my parents moved here from Amsterdam. My mother learned to speak English watching As the World Turns and Guiding Light. It was always a part of my life. And really, before I knew what I wanted to do with my career, I had applied for a job there out of college, but I didn't know that I would end up, sort of learning PR and communications at Disney. But I had applied, I didn't get the job. And then almost 10 years later, full circle, I got a job working for As the World Turns and Guiding Light as a senior publicist. And then leading the PR department when my boss decided to leave the business. And that was really, it was like a full circle moment. My mom was still alive, so it was pretty great. And it was great because it really got to use creativity, which I love.
Creativity in what way? Like, how would that help you in that job?
There's a big difference of getting on the telephone as a publicist and saying, hey, this is Alan from the Walt Disney Company, and this is Alan from As the World Turns or Guiding Light. Just the nature of the beast, and also the nature of the beast, because soaps had, been around 58 years by the time I arrived for Guiding Light. And, it was difficult. I mean, mainstream media didn't really cover the daytime world. Right. So you had to be creative in trying to find ways to get exposure for those shows. And, I'm really proud of a lot of things I did. I mean, there were, do you remember there was on the Learning Channel, there was a show called A Wedding Story.
Yeah, I remember that show.
Yeah. So basically they featured real life impending, bride and grooms. And one of the couples on Guiding Light was getting married for the third time. And I pitched the Learning Channel to see if they would cover, this wedding. And they basically gave us a 30-minute show as if they were a real life couple. So like we sat down interviews with the actors as the characters, so that type of
creative. That's fun. Yeah. Yeah.
It was really fun. And I like to toot my own horn that I created sort of an American Idol type contest before American Idol existed. We had taken As the World Turns to 10 college campuses, every television show, whether you're daytime, primetime, is looking for a younger demographic. Younger demographic is what sells to advertisers. So we had taken the show to 10 college campuses where we literally went out one week, had casting calls on each of those campuses, came back a week later and filmed with college kids from those schools. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, those episodes aired. So then afterwards, we were trying to think of ways to continue the momentum. And so I had pitched to the CBS morning show doing a live soap star screen test which was basically we picked five of those college students who we had hired when we were at their schools, flew them to New York. They appeared on the morning show doing a live screen test with an actor from As the World Turns, where viewers got to vote, and then that person won a week-long role on the show.
Nice. Yeah.
It was fun. I mean, it was fun, and you really had to think because, like I said, you know, they just, you know, mainstream media just didn't give.
Yeah, you know. Everything sped past the soaps, right? Like, the soaps are a really interesting narrative, you know, format that survived that age. Almost nothing else did. You know, I guess the sitcom kind of came along and things like that, but not the same sitcoms, right?
Well, everything we watch today is basically a soap opera.
Yeah, it's the same kind of Bridgerton, reality show dynamics.
Yeah, anything you watch, how to Get Away with Murder, they're all sort of soap operas. Did you know, interesting fact, did you know why soaps were created?
I do not.
Procter & Gamble created soaps to promote their soap.
Is that right? So it's that it's that directly named.
Correct. Yeah. They literally in like
soap
19
operas.
Soap operas. I think Ma Perkins might have been the first one. I might be blanking on that. But it, you know, a radio program back in the 30s. And basically, you know, to promote Palmolive, Dove, Tide, you know.
Well, it makes sense. I guess, that word opera, right? Like it's the big kind of broad good, evil, betrayal, all the things that you get in an opera.
It's so funny. I love saying that because so many people really don't realize that basically P&G, because P&G basically had at one time like 13 to 15 soap operas on the air.
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
It's almost starting
to come back. And now there's
four. What?
And now there are four left.
Yeah, well.
None of them are P&G, but there are four left.
It's funny how like the business structures come back around. Like what's happened now with, used to be, you know, only the networks and the studios had enough money to really do original shows. Then the cable companies came in there, the Amazons and the Netflixes. And now it's starting to move even further down, splinter even further, where companies are starting to look for original programming. It's the only way to get noticed.
Totally.
So it's going to come back around. Procter & Gamble is going to have 10, you know, primetime
shows. Let's hope so. It is really, and it is crazy the amount of television being produced today, you know, for all of the streaming platforms. I feel like it's, you know, and it's an incredible amount, and so much of it is really great television.
Yeah, because when you start to play the quantity game, you've got to get some quality that comes up in there, right? Mm-hmm. There's so much of it that's also pretty mediocre. Like when I got stuck in the pandemic, I finally realized, oh, I've gotten through media. I've watched all the good shows, and I've now watched them 3, 4, 5 times. And you keep trying new shows and going, oh yeah, they didn't quite get there, did they?
Yeah.
You know, but it's definitely fertile time for, like, if you're a creative and you can deal with all the forces that affect trying to put together an actual good show in this environment, if you can do something, it just explodes.
If you're a writer, man, and you can find the way in, it's pretty great because, I mean, they are looking, you know, every outlet's looking for content, like you said. And even, you know, Oreo is looking for content, you know, Coca-Cola, you know, because they want their product woven into those stories. So,
yeah, it's a pretty fascinating environment right now to work in entertainment. There's always been the interplay, like you're talking about, between the capitalist entity itself, you know, P&G, something like that. And the storyism and, you know, the idea of what the entertainment does, but it just constantly keeps remixing. You know, it's like, I know with shows like Fleabag, which came out of nowhere, I watched the first season before it got popular. And then the second season came out and they used more traditional storytelling in the second season with a love story. And it just exploded and became this massive phenomenon. But if you go back to the first season, and you can even see why, like, something like Procter & Gamble could never, you know, jump on that bandwagon, because the entertainment is so harsh. You know, the comedy is so hardcore.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff people want. So they're always pulling the business people more towards that uncensored material, because it's going to get reaction. And then the business is pulling people away from that stuff, because they don't want to get, you know, saddled with all those problems.
Fleabag is such a good show.
Oh, so good.
So good. I'm trying to think of her first show, which was on Netflix. I think it was called Crash, or
yeah, the
she yeah, did one season like of it, but it's very similar in nature to it, but it was also very good.
Okay, so you are now at CBS, right?
Procter & Gamble.
So you weren't actually working for CBS. You were working for
Procter & Gamble. I wasn't. I worked. Procter & Gamble, even though they produced 13 shows at, you know, one time, they never really handled the day-to-day. Their advertising agencies did.
Makes sense.
It does. I mean, they, you know, they weren't really, you know, they had them to promote their products. So it made sense that the advertising companies were the ones handling that. So yeah, I stayed there till, sadly, till both shows were canceled in 2009. And I was laid off during that recession. And then I got a job in November of 2010 for a TV and movie tour company in New York City called On Location Tours. And they basically take people around New York City, highlighting where various television shows and movies were filmed. So we had like the Sex and the City tour, the Sopranos tour. We had a Real Housewives tour for a short period of time. They still have a Turner Classic Movies classic film tour. So it was a way for me to still stay in the TV and movie arena. You know, that's why I really had applied for that job, because I loved, you know, the bridge of bringing a new industry, which was travel and tourism, still with the TV and movie element for myself.
It's really fascinating how deeply aligned with American culture TV and film really is.
Most people, if you think about it, and this is kind of a line I always said in marketing and PR efforts at On Location Tours, but no matter what part of the world you come from, whether me living here in New Jersey, Texas, Los Angeles, the UK, Australia, your first glimpse of New York City is through the TV shows and movies you watch. And for most people coming to take our tours, it's the reason that they're coming to New York. Is they actually, I mean, Sex and the City tour has been running since that show was created. And it's because every girl around the world wants to live in Carrie Bradshaw's shoes, basically. You know, it's really, and now with the remake of that show, that tour is going to still continue for probably another 10 years.
It is the power of that stuff. And again, I love to harvest from my dual backgrounds of academic rhetoric and then working in Hollywood. I try to tell people in business this all the time. When they hire my company to do marketing for them, I'm like, well, you have your choice here. You can poach from hardcore Aristotelian rhetoric, or you can poach from hardcore Hollywood, or you can just do standard business practice. Let me tell you, these two have a lot more power, and most businesses never really use that stuff. But just the clear pipelining build that Hollywood has for putting together messages, you know, they can coordinate 100, 125 people all working on the same show. And then people like you who are, you know, taking what these shows give you, figuring out what you can harvest from it to get it out into the media, to get publicity for it. Again, it's this very integrated process for creating a message and distributing it, you know, into the world. And businesses just are like, well, you know, just let's just have a meeting and we'll make it up.
Well, even think about, you know, let's use Sex and the City as an example. Even before On Location Tours created the tour, Sex and the City created an opportunity, and I without knowing that that show would hit the zeitgeist that it did and the success that it did, but by the love people had for each of those characters, every sneeze, piece of food, piece of clothing, you know, every step they took. So, you know, the pleasure chest, Budokan, where Carrie and Big had their engagement party, those businesses gained something that Sex and the City, I don't think, could have even imagined they were giving to businesses in New York City. And then we come along with, you know, a tour that takes women from around the world to all of these spots, lets them eat, shop, walk around those neighborhoods, see where Carrie lived. I mean, it really is an incredible extension of what that movie, that television show or movie never set out to do, really.
Right.
You know, unless, you know, unless it's a Disney and they partnered with A, B, and C, you know, but a lot of times it's just they're using it as a backdrop, yeah, or they're using it to have lunch, but they're not thinking that they're about to give that business 20 years of business. Right. You know, it's astounding. That
sense, I don't think people have really of what really great messaging does when it hits, like you said, the zeitgeist, when it grabs the pulse for people and they live their lives partially through what's coming to them from the screen. And then it affects their real life. They start dressing like that. They want to visit those places. They want to be that person. And again, when you're talking about politics and really strong messaging, having effects clearly all the way down into lived behavior, if you want to transform conservatism or MAGA or extremism or that kind of stuff, do it with those kind of messages, because the intensity of the messaging coming from the right, it captures America, like it's all reusing American nostalgia, which is a super strong story. That's why you see these guys driving around in trucks with the American flag, because it's already built into the culture strongly. So they're just inhabiting that message that's already been lived for so long. And when you see like really strong TV shows, the reverberations through lived lives and kids doing this and across generations, just superpower.
Well, the reverberation is even fascinating because, you know, having spent 10 years at On Location Tours, one of the most fascinating aspects is Seinfeld, Friends, sort of How I Met Your Mother. Trying to think. Well, those three for sure. I mean, people are traveling from all over the world, coming to New York City, because in their eyes, those shows took place there. But what those people also don't realize is that those actors never stepped foot in New York City, and those shows were filmed in California.
Yeah.
And it's always, you know, to say that to somebody and see their face like drop, it's just, you know, but they are, you know, it's sort of that messaging. It's convinced, you know, they are convinced this is, you know, the Friends apartment building exists in New York City. You know, people show up there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, thinking that they actually, you know, filmed or lived in that building. They, you know, they've never been there.
Right. Yeah. I worked at, my first job was at Best Dance Sports Show, which is filmed on the Fox lot in Beverly Hills. And that's where the New York backlot is that so many of those shows use.
Yeah.
So exactly. I would just, you know, I would take breaks and just walk. Yeah, I'm going to walk through New York. And here you go.
But it is, I mean, the power, you know, there is a belief that what they're viewing. So you know, thinking about messaging, I mean, they think that they're actually, you know, they believe that, you know, when you tell them, you know, Seinfeld never, it's almost like they really, it's like almost, you know, not to go back to the vaccine, but it's almost like people can't believe fact, it never filmed in New York City.
Well, literally part of the, when you get into deep theory about rhetoric, one of the theories that helps explain this stuff comes from a lot of French philosophy. This guy, Jean Baudrillard, which is actually on that bibliography that I sent you. And he wrote about the simulation of existence, the simulation of reality. When TV gets so good and, you know, our production capacity gets so good, it becomes better than the real. It's more vibrant. It's faster. It's edited. It's multi-sensory. And when you grow up an entire culture with that stuff, completely immersed in that, they can't hold on to the reality the way they used to. And so it's literally what you're talking about. Fact is something that comes from real reality. There is no fact in mediated reality ever. The whole thing about Afghanistan going on right now, I've tried to explain to people, it's a fire hose of imagery coming at you, and pundits, and, you know, visuals and video and all this stuff. It can never still capture what's going on there. It's capturing this tiny little range.
Right.
And what TV news has to do in order to compete has to pick the most spectacular images, the most intense stories. So everybody's completely emotionally charged up. And it's not a conspiracy. It's built into the media. That's what it does. Like, you don't watch boring movies. Like on soap operas, you have to find the craziest storylines.
Right.
Right. And that's what we're used to. That's the reality we're used to living.
Tired of that reality. You know, it's interesting. But I spent 10 years with On Location Tours. And then, of course, you know, the pandemic hit and tourism was the first thing to drop like flies. And, you know, how lucky was I to lose my job for a second time during another recession?
That's rough. Yeah.
And this one's a lot larger. But, you know, then I, you know, created this behind me.
Talk about this. Let's get some time in on your podcast. Explain to people what that is. And
it's really initially, cool. It was basically, I was laid off. I think my last day of work was March 20th. And As the World Turns has a television anniversary on April 2nd. And on April Fool's Day, I was just at home, needing to turn off the news about COVID. And I just thought, maybe, you know, I'll see if some actors want to, you know, join me on Instagram Live and say hello, really cheer people up, because the shows had been off the air for 10 years by the time the pandemic hit. And I called a few actors and they had said yes right away. And then one of them just said, hey, why don't, you know, see if we can do it on a streaming platform. I'll find out what my Broadway show that I was just in used, because they did one. He told me, and we did our first show April 3rd for As the World Turns. And I planned a couple shows after for Guiding Light and World Turns, and I was going to go back and forth just because I was going to do something that was easy with people I knew. And to really, at the time, it was my initial idea was thinking of the fans. We were all locked up, and, you know, I just thought daytime fans might be disconnected from their family. They might be able, you know, we could all use a little smile right now. And I think it just was the right time, and the convergence of all of that made people really excited about, you know, seeing familiar faces. And they kept asking me to do shows I didn't work on, actors I didn't know. And I just started asking people. And next month, I'm going to host my 200th episode. And
that's a lot.
It's a lot. Interviewed about 550 guests. Some repeats, you know, within a show, you know, some actors have come back to surprise other actors, but still, it's almost 550 different people. But I've done primetime and movies and authors, and I created, you and I were talking about it, I created Conversations with Alan, which is a sub-series that I try to do once a month to have conversations about the rise of hate, racism, and anti-Semitism, because both of my parents were Holocaust survivors. And it's been an amazing experience. I love doing it. I hope whether I am able to turn this into a job and make money doing it, or get a job that I will still continue to do it, because conversations like this, whether they're here on your show or on mine, I think everybody can learn from conversations.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating to me to watch the emergence of this stuff and the way it gets start to expand, the way it gets used and its capacities and the things that it can actually do. I was a professor for 20 years and I could lecture because I was also a stand-up comic. I knew how to keep people interested in a live setting. So I knew how to do dialogue monologue, which is essentially what you need to do these days to keep kids listening. They don't listen to monologue very well. They're not used to it. They're used to narrative and visuals and theatricality and sound and all that great stuff.
Visuals for sure.
Yeah. It's just what they've grown up for, and they hate to read and they hate to be lectured to. So when you start making adjustments like that, where you bring in another format, like I could bring in stand up, like there's all these crazy techniques in stand up to force people to listen in a good way, like so that you know how to basically charm their brain. And when you can combine those things like this, like something like your history, this kind of deep history you've got with this format of soap operas and your experience in entertainment, and you bring it to a podcast, that's never really been available before in the world.
Yeah. I mean, you know, when an actor or even an author is on a show, they get 2 to 3, maybe 6 minutes at the most. So it's just an opportunity to really sort of have I feel a much more real conversation. You know, I'm not looking to, you know, I sometimes get comments that I'm too nice or I'm not looking to get anybody.
Right.
But I want to have an interesting conversation, because I do think whether you're an actor or an author or, somebody from, an organization that, a charitable organization or, like the Anti-Defamation League, we all can learn something. I can learn from your experience. You can learn from my experience. I mean, there's all opportunities to learn. And I was never like, I wasn't a great student. But I think that just comes with age, where you realize there's a lot to learn in the world. And, I think learning is a just a great opportunity to be in the world and learn.
I know exactly what you're saying. Like the idea of a podcast of kind of listening in on an interesting conversation. Right. So like, I know what soap operas are. I grew up with my mom watching soap operas.
Oh yeah. Your connection. You said you had
so when I worked at CBS, you're basically on a talk show. I was at the Late Late Show, which is Letterman's second show. Yeah. And it was filmed in LA, but once you write the script by like 11, 1130, you're basically done for the day. So you're always looking for stuff to do. And this was really before, the internet was really a thing where you could just surf all day. And so I would watch the feeds when they were shooting the soaps. Yeah. And it was super fun to watch in between takes, because they'd keep the microphones on and the actors would be talking to each other. And I'm like, I feel like I'm getting to know these people.
Yeah. Yeah. Watching a feed is so fun on any show, whether it's daytime, primetime or anything. But watching actors do their business is really fun.
Yeah, it is. And people you don't get access to that world. You don't get the texture of that world when you're not in that world. And it's fascinating to me. And that's one of the reasons I like doing this podcast, talking to people like you. I follow my authentic interests, because I'm like, oh, that must have been an interesting environment. I mean, it's like anything else, it's a job and it becomes, rote and things like that. But there are also all these little details that you carry away from all those years that nobody else in the world has.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, that's why I told you I really would love to do something on rhetoric. We just have to figure it out. But I would love to, not figure it out, but I'd love to sort of discuss it sort of through the years, especially because, having parents who were Holocaust survivors and not fully grasping what my parents had lived through until much later in life. There's a lot I don't know about that period of time where they were, hidden away and lost their, dad and sister and family members. And, sadly, you know, people who might be listening to us, I mean, I personally, it's my belief that our previous president used a lot of the same rhetoric that I believe Adolf Hitler used to gather his Nazi army to do his bidding, per se.
The Germans, the Nazis were the first ones to go into media and outlandish, you know, rhetoric, that kind of totalitarian rhetoric. The Italians did it too, the Spanish with Franco. There are a lot of countries that got swept up in that because, and it was really because of the new media, because of film. The Nazis literally handed out transistor radios to everybody so that they could hear Hitler's speeches and they could hear all the other propaganda. And what's happened now, my theory, at least one of my central theories rhetorically, because I also do media theory and how it interacts with rhetoric, is this idea that the social media makes distribution free, instant, global. And so all these old stories, all these old rhetorics of authoritarianism and fear of immigrants and deep conspiracies and supernaturalism and all this crazy stuff, it's just being filtered back up to a new distribution platform. And we're not used to defending ourselves from it. America's never really had much of that. Like, we've had the KKK, we've had some extremist groups, but typically they handed out, you know, flyers and they had secret meetings. Right. Now they're out in public yelling this shit and we're not ready for it. We're not used to defending ourselves against that type of rhetoric. You can learn, you'll have to learn, and Americans will have to learn. It's gotten to be a more complicated environment. You can't let your grandmother just hear this shit because she's going to absorb it. Her brain is not ready to defend against this stuff.
And as we noticed, a lot of people aren't, because they attacked the Capitol.
Yeah, it's a fairly well absorbed rhetoric right now in America. But on the optimistic side, I will tell everybody that all of that can be erased. You can drag people back out of it, but you have to know what you're doing. You can't just attack them and say they're crazy. Yeah, they're crazy. They've absorbed a crazy rhetoric. And so you've got to extract that. You've got to have techniques for getting that out of their heads. And that's
what I want to talk about.
Yeah. So I
that type of stuff, the techniques, because I do. Because I've actually seen it on the news. I mean, where people who believed the BS, who have come out of it, you know, had that awakening, realized that there is no QAnon, you know, like there is, you know, August 13th passed and, you know, the former president didn't get reinstated, you know, like people wake up. And I've watched some people, you know, just admit how they fell prey to that. And, you know, I definitely, you know, would love to understand that more and understand how it happened, you know, during my parents' time, and understand how it's happening today, because I do believe, you know, the locker room audience is large because of the daytime fans. You know, these shows that I do, Conversations with Allens, do not get as many views. But if I get one person who says, you introduced me to something or you changed my perspective, it's been worth every hour I've put into this.
Yeah, and I agree. And one of the little sub things that I do, it's called Convert One Conservative. I'm going to do this as a nonprofit at some point, because instead of trying to take on the whole world, if you just pick somebody in your life that's lost in that rhetoric and you do some focused time with them, you create a better relationship, get them to trust your ideas and your information because they trust you, you can pull them back. But it's don't in any way think it's easy, because persuasion like that is a grind. You're fighting something as big as Disney that has gotten into their head. And do you think you're going to get in there with a couple of nice little, you know, quips?
No,
it's
no, I've learned that. Yeah, I've learned that. And that's why I'm so glad Lunch Club introduced us, because I think it's a fascinating conversation rhetoric, the whole idea of it.
I think when, you know, when you talk about like techniques, specific techniques, like you are a technique, like the fact that you at some point, like we talked for almost an hour before you said my parents were survivors of the Holocaust. So you're humanizing that, you know, as a second generation coming from that. And there are people, you know, when you get in and absorb these rhetorics that deny the whole Holocaust and all that. But there's a big difference in being able to deny the Holocaust as a fiction and knowing somebody or listening to somebody and listening to their story about their parents, because it makes it, again, it drags it out of media back into reality. And those are the kind of transition points where you can recover people. But unless they meet people like you directly, it all stays in abstract fiction. And you can believe anything in an abstract fiction.
Yeah. And that's why I try to, you know, that's why I'm glad I, you know, now have the platform and I can continue to say it. I mean, you and I would not be having this conversation if it was not for the people who risked their lives to save my parents.
For sure. And if you hadn't worked on soap operas, you wouldn't have the platform for actually reaching some people and making this.
Correct. I would, you know, I mean, maybe as a daytime fan, I might've tried something, but it would not have been this because I had all the connections.
Yeah. And you're using them in the right way. You're getting notice. And then you're like, as you get some notice, you're like, I want to do something important with this as well. Not that that's, you know, just in itself has an importance for people, but the idea of moving it over into activism and doing some real stuff.
Correct. Activism. And I didn't do that, you know, as a younger man, because I didn't fully grasp. It took me a long time. But, you know, the thing about daytime, though, you do say doing this at the time I did it had an impact because I did, you know, the messages I get about helping people through this past dark year and a half means the world to me. Like I've, you know, I know that I know everybody handled this pandemic differently, but there are a lot of individuals who don't have family, who lost family, who were disconnected from family. And, you know, you didn't really watch daytime religiously, but daytime fans, you know, believe they are family because they watch them 5 days a week. They basically see a character on television sometimes more than they see their own family.
Right.
So they truly, you know, those people are family to them. So that has also been rewarding to know that I've had some small impact on making this a little brighter for them during
the pandemic. And I think that is the best definition of real activism is when you find something of value to people who are suffering or, you know, and you can bring it to them in a way that offers them something. And the idea that you're offering community, a form of community because of their attachment to these people in the soap operas, and you can go in and extract stuff and say, hey, you know, I know it's tough out there. Let me give you this. That to me is what activism should be. It's finding all sorts of things like that, that maybe people don't normally think of, but it's something you can bring to it that's special and still gives people something important, you know, in their lives. So good for you. Good for you, Alan Locker in the locker room.
Thank you very much.
Well, this has been awesome. I appreciate you jumping on and
I appreciate you having me. Next time it's my turn. I will offline. We'll find a date, and you know, I want to talk about how to do it. But I, you know, and if you think there's somebody else to join you in that conversation who you know has a voice, you know, to it, it would be interesting if we could get somebody who is like a former white supremacist, which I've been wanting to do. You know, because I'm sure that they were a white supremacist because of rhetoric.
Yeah, most people have been indoctrinated into a heavy rhetoric. You know, they grew up in it, or they grew up in an organization or a family, and that's essentially the way people get usually to those positions. And so, you know, if you think about that as that is the process of creating that emotional and mental mindset, you kind of got to start from that. Like you can't talk your way through all of that. You've got to bring them to a different place, different way of living, different community. And then they start to recuperate sort of on their own. But if you can't get them out of that community, then you're going to have a hard time doing much work. So yeah, let's figure it out. We'll definitely do that. So tell everybody where they can find the locker room, promote yourself a little bit.
I will. at The Locker Room on Instagram and Facebook, and on YouTube as well, The Locker Room. All shows are up there, so please check it out. Let me know what you think.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I've enjoyed this very much. Appreciate you jumping on. Everybody go check out The Locker Room, and we'll wander back in and talk to Alan about rhetoric and all the good things you can do in the world.
We'll do conversations with Alan. He was my guest.
Nice. Well, this has been the Rhetoric Warrior podcast. Again, get out there and do some persuasion. Clearly people need it. See you next time.